reduced to civil infractions or dismissed, because the city of Boston is actively opposed to this pipeline. And that's whose court we're ending up in. You know, as Corinna mentioned, literally every elected official at every level other than the president and the governor who represent that neighborhood are opposed to this. Boston City Council unanimously opposed it.
We're going to have to leave it there, but we'll continue to cover this story. Tim DeChristopher and Corinna Gore, thanks so much for being with us. And that does it for our show. I'll be speaking in Chicago tomorrow night, Friday night, at 7:30 at the Hyatt Regency McCormick Place. Check our website, democracynow.org. Congratulations to Democracy Now!'s general manager, Julie Crosby, and Rebecca Wallach on the birth of their daughter, Ava Lee Crosby Wallach, born on June 24th. Welcome to the world, Ava Lee. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! We have job openings. Check our website. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5 o'clock. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. This year, the festival will be held July 1st through 4th at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. Everyone will need a pass this year to see such artists as Dr. John and the Night Trippers, Liv Warfield and the Special Horns, Curtis Salgado, and many more. More information about passes, the performers, the role of the Oregon Food Bank, and more can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2016.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 16th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, a two-day zine conference and social gathering on Saturday, July 9th and Sunday, July 10th in Portland. From 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. on Saturday, there will be tabling and workshops at the Ambridge Event Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Then, on Sunday, July 10th, from 11 a.m. till 5 p.m., there will be workshops and a Skillshare at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, located at 1001 Southeast Division Street. Again, that's the 16th Annual Portland Zine Symposium, Saturday, July 9th, and Sunday, July 10th. More information about Skillshares, speakers, workshops, and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the City of Portland is making a historic move today on affordable housing.
The state of Iowa's Supreme Court ruled 4-3 to reject a challenge to its felony disenfranchisement law, which bans felons from voting for life.
Democracy's spring cycle rides through town tomorrow, bringing light to the plutocracy and chalking up City Hall. We speak to one of the organizers.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 30th, 2016. I'm Robert Barncourt.
And I'm Natasha Delapine. Our broadcast begins. Portland City Commissioners have approved a ballot measure that will give voters a chance to approve a bond measure dedicated for affordable housing construction. KBOO spoke with Jess Larson from the Welcome Home Coalition earlier today about the effort and why it's needed.
Actually, Portland is doing a really good job addressing homelessness in this growing market, this tight market with everyone knows rents are up an average of $128 for every renter across the board in 1 year alone. So everyone feels this pinch. And even in the face of that, we as leaders, as advocates, as frontline social service workers, we are doing amazing work because I don't, as of 2000, 2015, when we did our last point in time count, homelessness did not grow that much. But what we do know is that homelessness changed a lot. There are more women than ever who've been homeless. There are more kids than ever who are homeless. There are more grandparents than ever who are homeless. And there are more people of color than ever who are homeless in our community. And all of that is because we now can point directly and see that despite our great efforts in trying to end homelessness for individuals and bring families back inside with all of the services and supports that we are putting out every day across the board, it's amazing work. Despite all of that amazing work, this is an economic crisis. This is a crisis that stems from people who have limited resources and cannot compete on this market. You can't take a Social Security check and open up Craigslist and try to find an apartment that rents for $500 a month anymore, which is what you can afford on a Social Security check. That $500 apartment is gone. It will never return to Portland. It does not exist on the market. So we do have a housing crisis. We have an affordable housing crisis in that there aren't enough deeply affordable homes for people with very low incomes, for people on fixed incomes, for Portlanders who need them most.
Stay tuned to KBOO News next week for more on this issue.
Yesterday, the Portland City Council approved a 1% tax on new commercial and residential construction. The tax is estimated to raise about $8 million a year and will be used to fund affordable housing projects. Housing Commissioner Dan Salzman hopes that this tax will guarantee that, quote, growth pays for growth. This new tax hopes to fund the estimated 24,000 housing units that are currently needed for low-income Portlanders. Salzman recognizes that, quote, the lack of affordable housing is the greatest crisis facing our city right now.
A new corporate tax measure called Initiative Petition 28 is set to go on this November's ballot. According to a report by union-backed nonprofit R. Oregon, the tax could raise $3 billion a year. The report predicts 20,000 new jobs in the next decade through increased spending in the public sector. A different report by State Economics predicts that the tax would result in 23,000 fewer jobs in the next decade. While the status on job creation is unclear, both reports express concern that this type of tax could pass the burden onto consumers.
Latoya Hampton with Community Upgrade leads a babysitting training at the Black United Fund this Saturday. It'll combine entrepreneurship with leadership and professionalism training for kids ages 10 and up. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Latoya Hampton about her upcoming class this Saturday.
The way my style works, in addition to doing the, you know, trying to balance with the good, fun parts of babysitting and the not so fun parts, is that as soon as they walk through the door, literally, as soon as they walk through the door, I am assessing their ability to pay attention to detail, follow instruction, take initiative, all those things that can later cross over into other areas of their lives for the rest of their lives. And so we really do focus on that. You know, first and foremost, you are taking care of another living, breathing human being that cannot be replaced, cannot go to the store and replace this person, you know, if there's an accident. The other thing is that their safety. And then how do they present themselves as really an entrepreneur and a professional? And so I tell them, I said, I'm going to give you a pretty big word. Yeah, you're coming to class today, but guess what adults call this? Adults call this professional development. So now you can go to your babysitting interviews, because we talk about that. You don't just, you know, walk up to somebody in the park because they have a kid and say, oh, can I babysit for you tomorrow? So we also talk about their safety. How do they get the word out that they are looking to babysit? And so we talk about the importance of having an interview, meeting with a potential family before, and the child before they make their decision, and all the questions they're going to ask even before they make the decision. But we talk about that. You know, what are the qualities that they have and how to communicate those skills and strengths and qualities and maybe some things that they can be better at. So just like when we go to a job interview and, you know, yes, the employer is questioning us to see if we're going to be a good fit, but I also encourage the youth to be assessing for themselves, is that family and is that child or the environment that they're going to be caring for the child, is that going to be a good fit? You know, again, everybody is welcome, but I would be remiss to, not include that I would love to see more people of color. Would love it. You know, I do these classes. I just finished Multnomah County Library. Just did an awesome thing for the community by having these classes free to the public. And, and they had them in Southwest Portland and in Gresham and in Southeast. And, you know, mostly... I had Caucasian young kids, and I love kids, period, so it was great. I love sharing knowledge. But honestly, I would love to see more kids and families of color take advantage of these opportunities. So, and more boys as well. So,
for KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Again, that class will be this Saturday at the Black United Fund of Oregon. You can find out more about the class on Facebook at Community Upgrade LLC.
An ODOT project 30 years in the making is finally a reality. The Sunrise Expressway will be opening tomorrow, July 1st. The new 2.5-mile stretch of road connects the Milwaukee Expressway to the Clackamas Highway. A shared bike and pedestrian path will open alongside the four-lane highway beginning at 5 a.m. tomorrow. Construction for the expressway began in 2013 and is estimated to have cost around $130 million.
This weekend marks the third anniversary of the oil train explosion in Lac Mégantic, Canada, that killed 47 people and it burned down half the town. The newly formed Climate Action Coalition will be commemorating the disaster. And here at KBOO to talk about this is Kathy Spofford. Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
So thanks for coming in. For our listeners who might not know about this thing that happened in Canada, can you explain what happened on July the 6th of 2013?
Well, there was an unattended 74-car freight train. It was carrying Bakken crude oil, and the train had been stopped in the town. And it, for some mechanical reason, it was left on, and the engineer left the train, and the brakes failed, and it rolled into town at about 1 a.m. in the morning, and it exploded. And the 47 people were killed, and as you said, a third of the town was destroyed.
And it was containing Bakken crude,
Bakken crude oil.
The North Dakota fields?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's... potentially explosive, not just flammable, is that right?
It's very explosive. It's much more explosive than other oil that has been transported by rail.
In the past?
In the past, yes.
So this is something new that we're having to deal with.
Yes.
And yes, we'll get to that local thing. So tell us about your take on the movement against climate change and how it's growing here in Portland.
Well, particularly since the Mosier accident, I've noticed a real increase in people who are very concerned and trying to find out more information and become active. There's a lot of groups that are working together. The Climate Action Coalition has, I think, 10 groups now that participate in the coalition. So there's many people who have become more aware and more energized to work against climate change.
Were you involved in the protest at the BNSF site last week?
No, I was out of town. But
oh, yeah, I heard that 150 people showed up for it. It would be good if we could get more.
And Monday there were 200, or Tuesday there were 200 people over in Vancouver at the adjudication hearing for the Tesoro Savage proposed terminal.
Which is not yet finalized, is that right?
No, not yet, no.
So they're letting public input happen on that.
Yes.
And so who is part of this Climate Action Coalition here in Oregon? Who's working with you?
Well, there's a number of groups, large groups like the Sierra Club and 350 PDX. There's smaller faith-based groups. I belong to a group called HOPE, Heal Our Planet Earth. There's a group over in Vancouver, People of the Heart. There's Oregon Fair Trade, the Raging Grannies, some smaller groups, No KXL, Portland Rising Tide, Beyond Fossil Fuels, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. So there's quite a diverse group of people.
Mm-hmm. And concerning the Mosier derailment right here in our own gorge, when you first heard of it, what did you immediately think?
Well, I was worried about the loss of life. I was worried that people could have been injured or that the river could have been contaminated, fish could have been affected.
And have you tried to get any more media coverage on it, since not much has been spoken about it since they supposedly cleaned it up and told us everything was okay?
Well, I think there's a lot of groups that are working on trying to get the word out. There's a new rapid response network that was over in Vancouver, and we'll be having more actions. We'll be collaborating with them. When we have our remembrance next Wednesday, we're preparing a map that shows the railroads through Portland with the blast zones highlighted. So people may not realize that the train goes right through Portland. It goes past Providence Hospital. If there was a blast, say, in the northeast, it could affect Benson High School, Lloyd Center, the Moda Center. It's all within the evacuation zone.
Well, what is the destination of these trains?
They're going up north towards Tacoma. They're going across Hayden Island and up into Washington.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, KBOO News did a People on the Street interview a few days after the Mosier derailment, and no one, not one single person, knew anything about the trains, the fact that they mm-hmm. are more explosive than anything before, or where they're coming from or where they're going to. And how will the Climate Action Coalition reach out to these people and inform the public?
Well, we're going to collaborate with the rapid response team, and we will be trying to educate people so that they know that the trains do go through our area, where they go. When they see the map, they'll be able to look up their own neighborhood and street and see how close it comes to them or their child's school. I think we'll do a lot of educating through direct action, through flyers and other events.
And these Bakken oil trains are coming on the Oregon side of the gorge?
Some of them come on the Oregon side. A lot of them go on the Washington side. Oh. But if the Tesoro Savage terminal is built, we'll have a lot more coming through the Oregon side.
More will come on the Oregon side?
Yes.
And then it'll have to cross the bridge?
Then it crosses the bridge, yes.
Oh, that's okay. And so what do you think is the most important thing for people to know in general about the movement that you're involved in, which is against climate change?
Well, that we have to keep fossil fuels in the ground is the most important thing, and that they can enter the movement at any point. There's so many things that people can do, from educating themselves, educating other people, taking direct action, helping different organizations. So we hope that they'll come next Wednesday and see our presentation, which will be at Pioneer Courthouse Square between 11 and 2. We'll do three different presentations, and people can sit, and we're going to highlight the lives of the people who were killed in Lac Mégantic. We're not going to focus on the disaster, but on that day, we really want to remember the lives of the people.
And that'll be at Pioneer Courthouse Square from 11 to 2?
Yes, on July 6th.
Have you done this every year since the...
I think this is the third year. Last year is the first year I participated, and we had a silent vigil along the railroad tracks.
Okay, and just for our listeners' benefit, what can they do to support your organization?
Well, they can come out on Wednesday mm-hmm. and see the presentation. There'll be a lot of tables with different groups, letting people know what they can do, how they can sign up, how they can get active, how they can learn more and educate themselves and their friends and families.
So there'll be flyers and...
There'll be flyers and tables and information.
3 hours long.
Each presentation is about 50 minutes long. People can stay for as long as they want. They can sit and we're going to spend 30 seconds memorializing, remembering each person in poetry, written word, song.
Very good. Pioneer Courthouse Square.
Yes.
From 11 to 2. All right. Well, that covers the whole subject that we had here tonight. I want to thank you for coming in. This has been a a good visit. Kathy Spofford has been with us. She is with the Climate Action Coalition of Oregon, and they're concerned about, of course, the climate change and also about the movement of fossil fuels through the gorge and through our city and our region, and hoping to get support from the public, from you, to come out. And you can find more about their work on Facebook at Climate Action Coalition. You can also go to www.climate-action-coalition.org. Thanks for coming in, Kathy.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Approval for a Canadian oil pipeline has been overturned in 2014. The then conservative Canadian government approved building an oil pipeline running from the Alberta tar sands to a port in British Columbia. But this week, that approval was denied. A Canadian Court of Appeals ruled in a 2-1 decision that the government had failed in its duty to consult with the affected First Nations groups on the project. The court sent the matter back to Justin Trudeau's cabinet for a, quote, prompt redetermination. Canada's original consultation with the First Nations communities had been, quote, too brief, hurried, and inadequate. The government had failed, the court said, to grapple with community concerns and showed no intention of correcting any errors or omissions pointed out by a regular panel review.
In the state of Iowa, their Supreme Court today ruled 4-3 to reject a challenge to its felony disenfranchisement law. The state of Iowa is one of only three states in the nation, along with Florida and Kentucky, to impose a lifetime loss of voting rights for people who have been convicted of a felony. Kelly Jo Griffin was convicted of a felony drug charge back in 2008 and sentenced to probation. Her attorney told her at sentencing that under an executive order by Iowa's then-governor, Tom Vilsack, she would be allowed to register and vote when her sentence was completed. Griffin's probation ended in early of 2013, so she registered to vote. But by that time, Iowa's new governor, Terry Branstad, had issued an executive order rescinding his predecessor's, once again taking away Griffin's right to vote. Griffin only learned of the change after she voted in November of 2013, and then she was charged with perjury for registering and voting. It took just 40 minutes for the jury to acquit her, following which Griffin filed suit asking the court to declare that the Iowa Constitution prohibits felony disenfranchisement for life. The court instead held that a provision in the Iowa Constitution regarding what it calls, quote, infamous crimes, permits the state to deny voting rights to people who are convicted of felonies. Here in Oregon, under our law, people who are convicted of a felony retain their right to register and vote after they have served their sentence.
The U.S. military is ending one of its long-time standing bans. Transgender people will be allowed to serve openly in the U.S. military, the Pentagon announced Thursday, ending one of the last bans on service in the armed forces. Saying it's the right thing to do, Defense Secretary Ash Carter laid out a year-long implementation plan. He said, quote, our mission is to defend this country, and we don't want barriers unrelated to a person's qualification to serve preventing us from recruiting or retaining the soldier, sailor, airman, or marine who can best accomplish the mission. According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, over 134,000 American veterans are transgender, while over 15,000 are estimated to currently be serving.
Last January, 10 U.S. sailors were captured by the Iranian government off the shores of that nation. They were far away from where their boat was supposed to be. Results of the Navy's investigation into the incident found that the sailors' poor navigation skills were made even worse by faulty equipment and then by bad decisions. In a rare public rebuke of their own people, the report says that the sailors failed to meet the code of conduct. The report says that some of the sailors disclosed computer and cell phone passwords and also, quote, sensitive data to Iranian officials. The sailors were traveling from Kuwait to Bahrain, but changed their route without notifying their superiors. The investigation showed that the sailors had no idea where they were due to navigation system errors when they were picked up by the Iranian officials.
In Africa, wildlife groups say rising ivory prices are accelerating the poaching of endangered elephants. The Kenya-based group Save the Elephants reports prices have nearly tripled in recent years, driving a wave of poaching in which at least 100,000 animals have been slaughtered between 2010 and 2012. But at FSRN's Nigalia Killian Chimtom reports African countries are stepping up enforcements and interdiction efforts are across the continent.
Elephants trumpeting have long been a familiar sound for locals here inside Cameroon's Bubajida National Park. But these sounds are now receding as the enormous mammals face increasing threats from poachers. Exact statistics are not readily available, but Kenya-based campaigner Frank Pope of Save the Elephants told FSRN that the illegal ivory trade in Africa has reached an alarming scale.
More than 100,000 elephants were killed in just 3 years between 2010 and 2012, and it doesn't look like there's been much decrease in the rate of killing since then. So many populations are being wiped out in Central Africa, and East Africa is also suffering from unsustainable declines, and even the previously immune populations of Southern Africa are starting to be affected now.
Now African nations are taking action. Cameroonian security forces recently seized 41 pieces of ivory aboard a passenger boat in Cameroon's south region. World Wildlife Fund's Cameroon National Director Hanson Gifoti says the ship's passengers went to great lengths to conceal the contraband ivory on their person.
This ivory we're talking of was put in boxes as if they were dresses. So you would normally not guess that something is hidden that far. The people have developed all type of means. And you know, you cannot check everybody. It's a very difficult thing.
That's because the global ivory trade has an estimated value of $19 billion. Ivory ranks fifth after illicit drugs, people, oil, and counterfeit currency. Asia is a major market for ivory. It can fetch around $3,000 per kilogram on the black market in China and neighboring countries, says Pope of Save the Elephants. He says it is this economic reality that drives poaching.
The high price of ivory attracts criminal cartels who make money off smuggling ivories along with other contraband like drugs and weapons and sometimes people. And those trafficking networks then incite people to poach ivory to make money by selling it to these criminal cartels.
Governments across Africa are sending a strong message to the traffickers in attempts to illustrate their political will to reduce the illegal trade. Ivory is being publicly destroyed. In April of this year, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta oversaw his country's annual ivory burn. Some 105 tons of elephant ivory, 1.35 tons of rhino horn, which combined could fetch around $172 million, were torched with great fanfare. In Cameroon, the Forestry Ministry set fire to 3.5 tons of elephant ivory with U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power in attendance to signal international support.
By burning this pyre, the government is sending a clear message to all who seek to profit from this monstrous trade, a message that the only place ivory belongs and the only place ivory has value is on elephants.
Critics see the burning of ivory stockpiles as money going up in smoke, advocating instead that the ivory could be seized, sold, and its proceeds invested. Campaigners in the field say police action is not enough to stop the ivory trade. Many of those involved are driven by desperate poverty, and the returns outweigh the risks. WWF's Hanson Gifoti argues that meaningful initiatives are too often inhibited by power brokers in high places.
It's more than just governance. It's really high-level corruption because the ivory poachers are now willing to pay a lot because of the price, because they can sell the ivory in China. The price of ivory is quite high in Asia And the people are willing to pay a lot of money for that. So they are willing to buy their way. Some of our uniform people are getting involved in the whole thing.
The poaching of elephants for ivory has also had a human cost. In April, a wildlife warden known here as an eco guard was captured and beheaded in Cameroon's Faro National Park. Poachers were suspected. Natural ecosystems often develop a web of interdependence, and the continued poaching of large mammals such as elephants could destabilize such interdependence and become a danger to vegetation, given that mammals are great agents of seed dispersal. Cameroon's wildlife ministry says it will continue to invest in eco guards, but officials here say that will do little unless the countries that harbor illegal ivory markets do their part. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6 o'clock. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be sunny again and about 80 degrees, another beautiful day. On this day in history, in 1966, the National Organization for Women was founded in Washington, D.C. by a group of 28 women. They had gathered for the third National Conference of Commissions on the Status of Women in order to air their frustrations about the Equal Opportunity Commission's failure to enforce Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, 2 years earlier than that, which had prohibited sex discrimination in employment. And the quote for today is from Gloria Steinem, who said, "A feminist is anyone who recognizes the equality and the full humanity of women as well as men."
Pedalpalooza is here, and along with it, a parade of fun biking events. The Democracy Spring Cycle on Sunday will move through the city to draw attention to big money corporations and voter suppression. Here to talk about the rise of is Matthias Quackenbush. Thanks for coming in, Matthias.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for all the effort coming in too. was it a bit of a pedal to get here as well?
Unfortunately, I've got a broken leg right now, so I can't actually ride in the ride, or unfortunately, I couldn't ride across the Burnside Bridge, which had horrible traffic, but I hobbled my way over on my crutches and made it just in time, looks like.
Can I ask how you broke your leg, Matthias?
Oh, it was just juvenile behavior, just clambering around a log up in Lacamas Lake near Vancouver, and slipped and fell and jammed it against a rock.
Sorry about that, but it sounds like you're having a fun time, at least, though, while you're doing it.
Yeah, trying to stay as high-functioning as possible, and keep kicking some butt.
Well, you're doing a good job.
Thanks.
Where did the idea of this ride come from?
Actually, it was just another member of our team. It's been kind of interesting. So Democracy Spring, I'm sure we'll get back to this, but we had this great massive disobedience action in D.C. last April, where 1,400 of us were arrested at the Capitol to call for an end to big money corruption and voter suppression. So then we started to think, okay, we got all these fired up people in Oregon. How are we gonna organize and keep this going as the movement expands throughout the country? So we had a lot of different like intelligences and minds that came together, and we've got people who are really interested in what we're going to need to do to bring in different diverse parts of our community to build this movement in a really dramatic way, so it's not just like all the same old like super awesome activist people that always show up to all the events, but we can really bring in new people and build the mass movement we're going to need to take back our democracy. So someone else, his name's Yute, actually he runs a business called MACVCX in the Hollywood district, and he's a great community organizer. It was actually his idea, but we kind of collaborated on the overall scheme for it.
What is the goal for this ride that you're doing for Democracy Spring?
Well, I mean, we're looking at doing a lot of different fun community events that you should all look out for. Follow us on social media, Democracy Spring Oregon on Facebook, especially this summer. And what our main focus is locally right now is we've got something called the Equal Voice for All Declaration. So we're reaching out to candidates and incumbents at every level, from municipal to national, and trying to get them to sign on to this very simple pledge to basically fight for pro-democracy reforms, move us towards a system of publicly funded elections. So our goal is to get people excited about that and bring people into the movement. And one of the many things we're going to be doing just through the ride is actually James Opsink, who's running for State Senate District 21. That's Diane Rosenbaum's seat. I actually ran into him at an event a few days ago. Turned out he was planning to go to the ride anyway, so he gladly signed on to our Equal Voice for All declaration. He's joining this, you know, this growing cadre of like pro-democracy leaders that we can really depend on to represent the people's voice. So we're gonna, part of it is we're gonna like give him a platform to say why these reforms are important and set an example for all the other leaders that we still need to sign on. Another thing we're gonna be doing is we're gonna be biking around to different sites, doing some kind of fun summer sidewalk chalking. Outside of places like, you know, Earl Blumenauer's office, Ron Wyden's office, potentially Jeff Merkley's office, and some local people as well, just to spread the word and show these power holders, these elected leaders that, you know, are doing, you know, varying levels of good work in terms of like actually representing the people who elected them. We just want to send the message that this issue is important, the people care about it. And we want this to be, you know, number one or very high priority going into November's election. And we're going to hold our leaders accountable for these reforms that really, you know, vast majority of Americans want. Something like 80-90% of Americans believe our democracy is corrupt. So you know, a big part of democracy spring is just inspiring people and making people realize that there are reforms. There are very basic like policy reforms. Many of them are already in Congress or at, you know, various levels. In Multnomah County right now, they're collecting signatures for a local anti-corruption act. We need 23,000 signatures by the end of August, and that would put some like sorely needed contribution limits, for one thing, on contributions to people running for office, make it possible for a much wider spectrum of people to actually represent us and create sort of a hedge against all the pressures of wealthy interest groups.
And how do our listeners get involved if they want to with the Equal Voice for All declaration that you have going on as well?
So probably the first one, just go to Facebook, follow us, Democracy Spring Oregon. You can go to also democracyspring.org, the national website. You can find there's a tab there for Equal Voice for All declaration. You can see who's signed on. We've had a great array of people locally sign on. Actually, we had Chloe Udaly and Steve Novick, both you know, who's running. Chloe's running for city council. Steve is the incumbent. They signed on. Of course, James Offsink, Rob Nose just signed on today. He's actually my representative, District 47, as well as his opponent, the independent James Stubbs, Alyssa Kenny Geyer. So we've had a great array of folks who have chosen to step up and take leadership and say, I'm committed to pro-democracy reforms. So if you go to the website and just follow us on social media, on Facebook, Democracy Spring Oregon, you can get all the tools you need to do some of that outreach. And it's really easy too. Just look up who's your local state representative, state senator, and just call them and ask them to sign on to the Equal Voice for All declaration. And of course, show up on Sunday and get to know us in person.
Matthias, what is your long-range goal for this ride in Democracy Spring?
Well, Democracy Spring as a whole, it's a big part of why I was attracted to Democracy Spring and 99 Rides, which is sort of the organization that initially spawned it, is that they think big. And this is really, I mean, big money corruption at the national level and at all levels is really a crisis. And it's impeding our progress on so many issues, everything from locally getting really like, you know, we've got like big property management companies lobbying a lot to prevent the reforms we need to get, you know, all the affordable housing that our city desperately needs at the national level. You know, we seem to be incapable of acting on things like climate change, mass incarceration. There are so many ways in which the people's voice has been totally crushed. In fact, there's a Princeton study that says the policy preferences of the average voter literally have no correlation with how Congress acts. Congress literally doesn't care what you think. Whereas if you look at, I think, the top 1% of people, it's like an 80% correlation, something crazy like that. So what we really want to do is create a powerful mandate for reform going into this 2016 election. And to do that, we want to put as many leaders at all levels as possible on record in support of that reform. And then, you know, after the election 2017, we're going to hold those leaders accountable for those reforms. And we actually have another massive disobedience action following up on what we did in D.C. coming up at the DNC, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. So the goal there is to really put pressure on the Democratic Party to prioritize these reforms that we need. And it's not a partisan thing. We're just pressuring this institution because it's an institution we believe we can move closer to our goals.
And how can our listeners support you without a bike?
Well, there's going to be a great, like, really fun rally. I mean, I'm not going to be able to ride, but I'll still be there. We're meeting at Oregon Park. That's roughly just off Sandy, I think, around 33rd. So Oregon Park, Sunday, 4 p.m. James Opsink will be speaking. I'll probably give a little quick talk, and we'll do some super awesome chants that we learned in D.C. when we were sitting at the Capitol. So it should be a great time. And and you can, like, also other forms of conveyance. If you got a skateboard, rollerblades, and you can keep up, more power to you.
Can you lay out some of the other issues that you'll be discussing at the forum and rally, as well as the biking event?
Yeah. Well, I mean, basically, like, our focus is really to drill down. Lauren Schlesig has a great TED Talk. He's a Harvard, like, I believe, law professor, about this issue of big money corruption and how every issue you can think of, every issue that's important to you is, there are so many issues that are really important and that have super strong impacts on people's lives. But addressing this corruption and taking back our democracy, this is the first issue. This is the issue we really need to address before we can make progress on any of those others. So this is what we're kind of trying to drill down on. And it's such a big issue, too. It's hard to get leaders to prioritize this. I mean, President Obama promised it when he was running for office. Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have both promised to overturn Citizens United. But it's because it's so big, it's likely to fall to the bottom of the pile of, you know, with all the divided mandate that people generally have going into office. So our goal is to push this back to the top and make it the issue that people really prioritize. And it may seem big, but every generation before ours has had a constitutional amendment, which is, you know, what we might need at the national level to overturn Citizens United and get the big corporate money and the dark money out of our political system. But there's lots of reforms we can do, push locally. And Oregon is really abysmal as far as corruption laws go. We have no contribution limits. We have no disclosure requirements. I think we're on par with like three other states, like Georgia, Alabama, basically. So there's a lot we can do at all levels.
Thank you, Matthias, so much for coming in, as well as all the work you're doing. And today, again, thank you for making the effort to get in here for the interview. I really enjoyed what you've had to say.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. So Sunday, 4 p.m. Oregon Park and Democracy Spring Oregon on Facebook. Join us. Thanks.
Thank you, Matthias, again. And this has been a KBOO. We're going on now. And make it out if you can for the event.
The American consumption of Mexican beer is leaving the residents of a Mexican border town without water for their daily use. The mayor, Leonicio Martinez Sanchez, says that a U.S. firm known as Constellation Brands is currently drawing water from a 500-foot deep well at the rate of 600 gallons per second. The town pumps water for its own population at less than a tenth of that flow, and the mayor has warned that, quote, "We are having no water for human consumption. There's barely a drop of water when you open the faucet." Constellation Brands, which purchased the brewery in 2013, produces Corona and Modelo. These are beers that are for export. The United States currently imports more beer from Mexico than from all other nations combined. Constellation expects an expansion, which is currently underway. This will increase production to 20 million bottles of beer per day by the end of the year 2017. And water crises, as you can well imagine, are common in this region of Mexico.
Let's say you haven't been in New York's Times Square in 20 or 30 years, and you're confused. Where are all the tardy sex shops and theaters showing XXX movies? Well, they haven't been there for a long time, having been replaced by places like the Disney Store. And now there's going to be something maybe even better, and certainly much more wholesome than consuming porn inside a dark theater, a $7 bowl of Rice Krispies. Yes, Kellogg's is planning on opening a Times Square cafe, serving nothing but cold cereals with milk, and, if so desired, fruit toppings. And you can get it any time of day. It'll be just like one in London that was destroyed by anti-poverty activists in a riot last year. At present, Kellogg's has disclosed no plans for opening a cold cereal food cart in Portland.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast has been Laura DeLago, Martin Dodge, Doug McVeigh, and Jenna Yokoyama. The producer is Sam Bowman. Our engineer is also Jenna Yokoyama. Thanks again. The KBOO Evening News Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter by trying the term KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Natasha Delapine.
And I'm Natasha Delapine. The 222nd meeting of the Presbyterian Church USA General Assembly concluded business Saturday at the Oregon Convention Center. John Shuck spent the week at the assembly and provides this report.
The Presbyterian Church USA has a long history. Presbyterians in the United States share a representative form of government. King George III referred to the American Revolution as that Presbyterian Rebellion. Today, the Presbyterians, like all historical Protestant churches in the United States, are steadily losing members and influence. The church is asking basic questions, such as its role and its future.
Last night, one of the young adults that I'm staying with here during the General Assembly came home and told a story about a friend who is not Presbyterian, but has been watching online and all the tweets about what's going on and all the Twitter feed about what's going on at the assembly. And she said that his comment to her was, "Wow, like this doesn't totally suck." Right? And I thought, that's it. That's what I'm aiming for that, right? I want that young adult who thinks that it all just sucks because the way we've been allowing ourselves to be portrayed and honestly, the way we have too often acted is as if we don't actually care about real people in real situations, that we care more about the doctrine and the belief sets. And what I want is a conversation about what happens when we start opening this up. My